Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 93. My name is Terry Frost and this time around I'm doing a bit of horror. I've mentioned that horror should be part of Martian Driving Podcast and there hasn't really been too much of it lately. So I decided to go with one slightly old, one slightly new. The new one is a horror Christmas comedy from 2015, Krampus, starring Adam Scott and Toni Collette. Then we go way back to 1971 for Harry Kummel's classic lesbian vampire movie, Daughters of Darkness, starring Delphine Seyrig and Andrea Rao. So sit back and I'll get the contact details out of the way. The lava lamp is bubbling away and it's time to get on with the show. Martian Driving Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in colour, 3D, anamorphic. It doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction or horror or fantasy or anything that takes our mind. So the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Please be aware that this podcast does have swearing in it. So if you're going to be listening to it on speakers, make sure there are no children around unless you want them to learn wider vocabulary than they already have. Hi, how is everybody doing? My throat's a little rough. It's not sore, but it's a little rough this time. Still got a little bit of that winter bug going around, but I'm going to muscle through and we'll get through the show, but the voice is not as dulcet as usual. The weather here is cloudy, but it's fairly warmish for this time of year. I really can't wait for summer. I'm looking forward to it. This winter, for some odd reason, seems to have dragged on way past its use-by date, and so the weather warming up is something I'm very, very much looking forward to. So, what have I been watching? In case you didn't listen to the last Paleo Cinema podcast, I mentioned that I did see Suicide Squad, and it's very problematic. I'm not going to talk too much about it because I don't want to lose my head of steam because Rebecca McLaren and I are going to be talking about it this Thursday on ABC local radio in the Northern Territory, and I want to keep my ideas fresh for that. Needless to say, it's very much problematic. There's some interesting rumours coming out about how Warner Brothers is managing the DC Extended Universe and what they possibly need to do to remedy the problems with it. The movies are very successful, but they're not very good, and the problem there lies is they'll get worse if the studio thinks that by making these movies in the way they are, that that's the way to success. Perhaps it will be for a short term, but I'm not sure it will be for a long term. And therein lies the problem. So I saw that with Sal, and she still hasn't forgiven me for that. Now, what else have I watched? There's a History Channel documentary. Well, it's a kind of mockumentary, alternate history thing called The Great Martian War. And the conceit at the centre of this History Channel program, which runs about the length of a movie, is that in 1913, Europe was invaded by aliens who have great big tripods. It's a kind of H.G. Wells, War of the Worlds kind of thing. And it goes through the history of what happens between 1913 and 1917 when ultimately the aliens are defeated. And it's a nice bit of alternate history. It really is nicely plotted, nicely laid out. They use real archival footage and CG together to tell the story. Some of the footage is slightly repetitive, but it's a really interesting little conceit. And if you haven't seen The Great Martian War, it's probably something that you want to check out if you're into steampunk for a start, and if you're an alternate history buff, which I know a lot of people are. So I watched that. Let me have a look at my Letterboxd. I did see the movie based on the computer game Warcraft. Now, I played Warcraft in the early days, Warcraft 1 and Warcraft 2, And so I'm kind of familiar with the world. I'm familiar with the orcs versus the humans thing, with the magic system and all that kind of stuff. This one was directed by Duncan Jones, the son of David Bowie, of course. It's a misstep in his career, I'll be honest with you. The CG is very good. The orcs are portrayed very well. But I don't think anybody's bringing the A-game acting to it. It's got a bunch of, you know, good jobbing actors that I've seen do other things well. But not really in this one. Maybe there was a difficulty because of the amount of computer-generated effects. Maybe they couldn't kind of get into it. It is set up for a sequel. And that should be kind of interesting as well. But for some reason, it's doesn't have the energy that you need for this kind of movie. There's a kind of innovation going on for some reason. I don't know the reasons why. I don't know much about what happened during the production of the movie, but it is a bit kind of dull, which is not definitely not the way you want something which is supposed to be the start of a franchise and which people are already pre-invested because of their gaming into liking. But yeah, it's worth seeing if you're a fan of the Warcraft computer games, but maybe not if you're not. One of the other things I watched was a movie from about 10 years ago, made by the late Tony Scott, and it's Deja Vu, starring Denzel Washington, Paula Patton, Val Kilmer, and a bunch of other character actors. Basically, a terrorist attack by a one-man terrorist squad. Domestic terrorist blows up a ferry on the river in New Orleans during Fat Tuesday and kills hundreds of people. So Denzel Washington's character is from the ATF and is investigating the murder. He finds one of the victims wasn't actually killed by the blast but was killed beforehand, and that character is played by Paula Patton. He kind of has a little bit of a Laura thing where he falls in love with a dead person in a way, and suddenly he's listening to her phone messages when he investigates in her apartment and hears his own voice on the voice messages. This then leads him via Val Kilmer into a secret project where they project wormholes back in time and can view anywhere once 6 days before. So the, you know, they try to kind of investigate the murder and to capture the bad guy, played by Jim Caviezel, which they ultimately do. But Denzel Washington's character decides he's going to actually go back in time and rescue Paula Patton's character. So it's got a little bit of that. It's a very good actioner. The action stuff right up from the explosion at the start all the way through is very good. It's very Tony Scott. It really does work well. But ultimately, it's kind of got that happy ending, Hollywood-y kind of thing about it. And there is something slightly creepy about Denzel Washington's character falling in love with a woman at whose autopsy he attends. And kind of doing that, it's that doesn't sit well. And for some reason, they decided that would be part of the movie. All the actors are really good in it, but Jim Caviezel's very good playing the domestic terrorist character. But ultimately, it's got that slight ickiness that I didn't really enjoy. I watched it on, I think, Netflix. And for the action stuff, I enjoyed it a lot. There's some really nicely played action things that relate to the time travel and to the wormhole, which kind of works really well. But when Denzel Washington goes back in time in order to stop the bombing and rescue his love interest, then that then becomes a little bit kind of weird for reasons I won't go into if you haven't seen the film. It's not a bad movie. The action stuff's good, but ultimately, I think the scripting just needed that little bit of extra attention that it didn't get. So that's about it for what I've been watching. I'm going to now play the trailer for Krampus and then talk about a really nice attempt to do a Christmas comedy horror movie, which doesn't quite work, but still has a few features of interest.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
With the kids jingle bells.
Merry Christmas!
Looks like Martha Stewart threw up in here.
This is delicious, honey.
A little dry.
Well, mine's delicious.
Mine's dry.
You want to trade?
It's the high. It's Christmas. It's Christmas. It's Christmas.
With those holiday greetings and gifts.
How we were going to survive Christmas with 12 people stuck in a house with no heat and no electricity.
Or food.
There's plenty of leftovers, Howard.
Beer it is.
It's the weirdest thing. There's no cars, no people.
How long can this keep up? We heard something on the roof.
The hell is this?
St. Nicholas is not coming this year. Instead, a much darker ancient spirit.
Those are hooves. Elk or a goat? What
kind of goat walks on its hind legs?
His name is Krampus. He and his helpers did not come to give, but to take.
Everybody, hold on to each other.
He is the shadow of St. Nicholas.
Christmas. Nothing bad's gonna happen on Christmas.
As I said before, Krampus is a 2015 horror comedy, a Christmas horror comedy. In fact, Krampus itself is an interesting Germanic legend. Our friends over at the Pedia of Wikis says, in Austro-Bavarian Alpine folklore, Krampus is a horned anthropomorphic figure described as half-goat, half-demon, who, during the Christmas season, punishes children who have misbehaved, in contrast to St. Nicholas, who rewards the well-behaved with gifts. Regions in Austria feature similar figures, and most widely, Krampus is one of a number of companions of St. Nicholas in regional Europe. The origin of the figure is unclear. Some folklorists and anthropologists have postulated a pre-Christian origin for the figure. In traditional parades and at such events as Krampuslauf, young men dressed as Krampus participate. Such events occur annually in most Alpine towns. Krampus is featured in holiday greeting cards called Krampuskarten. So Krampus is one of those fucked up Christmas legends. There are a whole bunch of them across Europe. Black Pete in the Netherlands and the Low Countries. There are a whole bunch of them around the place. In Haiti, there was Tonton Macoute, who was the opposite of Tonton Noel Santa Claus. Tonton Macoute used to grab bad children and put them in his knapsack and they're never seen again. And when the Duvalier regime came into Haiti, the basically hit squads of the regime were called the Tonton Macoutes. For that reason, people would be put into the back of their cars and never seen again. So there's some very dark Christmas legends out there, most of which have to do with reinforcing Christian doctrine, which is kind of uncool. Let people be who they are, let them believe what they like, and don't send supernatural entities around to reinforce Christian dogma. That's where I stand on that matter. But to get away from that for a moment and talk about the actual movie, it's a bit of fun. I mean, there are bits of that I really like, but I think the pacing is just a little bit out. But nonetheless, it is a bit of fun. As I said earlier, the movie, it's an American movie made by Universal Studios, but it was actually filmed in New Zealand. And Weta Workshop, who do fantastic effects work, did the effects for this one. It stars Adam Scott, Tony Collette, Dave Koechner, Alison Tolman, Conchetta Farrell, and Krista Stadler. It was written partly and directed by Michael Dougherty, who's done a few things. He did work with Bryan Singer on a couple of projects. In fact, he was one of the writers on Superman Returns, amongst other things. And his movie Trick or Treat really took off and was probably his most successful work so far. Interestingly enough, he is currently working, well, he has just recently worked on X-Men Apocalypse, which, again, is another problematic film with pacing issues. But this one I kind of like. It starts off with a montage of people doing the last-minute Christmas shopping in a department store, and they've got the cheerful Christmas music playing over it. But it turns into an all-out brawl. People are bashing each other with things, tearing presents out of each other's hands. It just kind of shows that nasty, commercialized part of Christmas in a very humorous way. It does end up being like an enormous Donnybrook. And you kind of get prepositions you for the fun stuff in the movie. And there is fun stuff in this film. It's hilarious in parts. But that does go to some very dark places, and I don't think it recovers back to that kind of fun Christmas comedy horror thing that we all know and love from movies like, say, Gremlins, which is set at Christmas. And Gremlins is one of those movies that are a touchstone for the makers of this film as well. The cast I liked, I do have a lot of time for the cast, stars Adam Scott, who I remember from Party Down, and he played the nasty brother in Step Brothers, amongst other things. He's very good. He's a good-looking actor, but he's very good at playing a good-looking asshole. In this one, he doesn't necessarily need to, but he... It's an interesting project for him. It's a bit out of his comfort zone, but I think he does a pretty good job with it. His wife, he plays a character called Tom. His wife, Sarah, is played by Toni Collette, fine Australian actor who has done enormous amounts of quirky roles and really does know her stuff. People remember her earliest from Muriel's Wedding, which is a beloved movie here in Australia. She was in things like Sixth Sense, United States of Tara, the TV series, and a bunch of other things, but she's mostly known as a character actor. But in this one, she does a good job playing the kind of housewife trying to deal with the family. Now, the family is an interesting lot of characters as well. Let me just take a look at this. The setup for the movie is basically Christmas Vacation with Chevy Chase and Randy Quaid and all of those kind of people. Some of the character stereotypes are kind of slightly borrowed from that. You've got Dave Koechner playing the gun nut who drives a Hummer. His character's name is Howard, and his wife Linda, played by Alison Tolman. They've got a whole bunch of kids who are very badly parented and who are nasty little fucks themselves. And they bring along Aunt Dorothy, played by Conchita Farrell, who's cynical and nasty and alcoholic, and they thought they were just going to visit her before Christmas, but she turned up at the front door with a suitcase. So they took her along to Tom and Sarah's place. Tom and Sarah have a boy called Max and a daughter called Beth, and they're doing the best they can to do the parenting thing, even though the family coming to stay for Christmas are a bunch of nightmarish characters. They do set up that family as kind of the default normal one, but Max is troubled, and his confidant is Omi, his grandmother, Tom's mother, who is Austrian and speaks German to Max, who understands her, and as indeed does Tom. And she kind of knows more about the situation than she's saying. So the family gathers together. They all kind of bond, but Max, because the family are just such assholes to him, and just assholes in general, tears up his Christmas letter to Santa and throws it out the front door, and it swirls up into the moonlit sky, and that's the trigger for Krampus to come visiting. Suddenly things start going wrong, the power cuts out, an enormous overnight ice storm blows through, and the whole of their street is suddenly bereft of people and cars and any signs of life at all, as all the houses are heavily covered in snow and icicles, and shit's just getting bad. So the people, first off, have got to survive Christmas with their family, plus they've got to survive Christmas with their family with no power and no connection to the outside world. And then things start happening. People start disappearing.
weird supernatural events happen. A great big hook with a gingerbread man comes down the chimney and lures one of the children who gets caught and tied up in a chain and dragged up into the chimney. Shit just starts getting serious and weird. There are gingerbread men armed with nail guns and carnivorous jack-in-the-box and vampiric Christmas angels and feral teddy bears and toy robots with kitchen shears, and the house gets invaded by some very feral Germanic elves, and basically shit gets unreal. And riding over this herd of mischief is Krampus, who we see mostly as a hunched figure in furs with bells and chains on and goat hooves and enormous horns on his head. And we don't see him for most of the picture, mostly because the effects work on Krampus himself isn't as good as some of the other stuff. But you do see him in the distance when one of the characters is walking down a street. And we see this hunched, horned figure on the roof of one of the houses who leaps up into the night and lands on one of the other houses on the other side of the street. It's a very effective little piece of work, that. And it takes us into a different kind of horror than the comedy horror stuff we're kind of expecting from this movie. The movie does set things up being that kind of icky and, you know, the kind of horror you get in, say, the original Willy Wonka movie, where the kids are treated badly, but there's a slight humour to it. It doesn't quite play out that way. For a start, Krampus and his minions are a little too horrifying in some ways. The feral Christmas angel in particular, and the gingerbread men, yeah, they're funny, and the killer robot, which comes out of nowhere and isn't really in tune with the rest of the monsters there. The elves who invade owe a lot more to Rob Zombie than they do to Gremlins, for instance. And the problem with the characters is, too, if you have a look at a movie like Gremlins, there are a lot of over-the-top human characters in there to balance off the over-the-top Gremlins. And you don't really get that sense of that particularly much in this movie. Dave Koechner's really good playing Howard. I think he's one of those comedy actors. He started out doing Saturday Night Live, amongst other things. But he's one of those comedian/actors who is really good in character roles. You can see something in his Howard that I want to see more of in Dave Koechner's career. And that's a bit of fun. He really does. The character does go through an arc. He starts out as a caricatured, redneck, right-wing, working-class guy with dumb opinions who probably is going to vote for Donald Trump. But as shit gets serious and his family starts getting threatened, we get a little more complexity from the character, which I like. I like the writing in that, and I like the way Koechner plays it. Adam Scott's character as well goes through a similar arc of looking after his family, and even though he's kind of what Howard thinks of as a lily-livered liberal, actually brings it when his family is threatened, and that's kind of good, as indeed does Toni Collette's character. Even the drunken aunt gets a bit of an arc. Aunt Dorothy, she kind of ends up looking after the kids, and she hates kids, and she said she hated kids even when she was a kid. So she's kind of got that built-in cynicism. But nonetheless, when needed, the family bonds together. The movie ends on a very dark note. Most of the characters die, and then you get that setup which maybe makes us believe that it's all a dream, but it turns out it's not all really a dream. But just to kind of look over this movie, I like it for a number of reasons. First off, it's trying something different. It's bringing Christmas legends from other parts of the world. It's trying to remind us of those 1980s horror comedies we all love. Ghostbusters, of course, which I mentioned in the last podcast, being one of those examples. And it's got a very different look, but I think tonally it does need a little bit of work, which it unfortunately doesn't get. And I do like Krista Stadler playing Omi, the grandmother. There's a sequence where she talks about something that happened in her own childhood, which relates to Krampus and his history with the family. And that flashback is illustrated like a storybook. It looks a little bit like the movie based on Neil Gaiman's Coraline, but it's still got a fairy tale look to it. It's a beautiful little sequence, really nicely done, Weta Workshop probably did the effects on it, but it's lovely and it steps us out of the kind of intense horror reality of what's happening in the house as Krampus and his minions attack, and shows us something a bit beautiful and a bit unexpected, which I really did appreciate in this film. It's got the parts, there are bits of the parts that are more than the whole, in a way, with this movie. The acting is first class, some of the effects are very good. The Krampus mask and the Krampus character is, for a titular character, treated like a generic monster in some ways. I'd like to see a Krampus that actually gets some dialogue and who teases and taunts the family and kind of gets a bit more involved. But this Krampus is a bit different from that and does look like a monster in a Rob Zombie kind of movie. There's some very evocative scenes in this film which are maybe a little out of place in something that's trying to be a horror comedy. The characters walking down the snowy, blizzard-covered streets. There's some kind of moments of awe and wonder in that. The idea of the whole town being snowbound and everybody disappearing except for this one family is very, very creepy. The fact that snowmen start appearing in the front lawn and nobody they know builds them. There are those kind of moments of just little grace notes that make this a bit more interesting. But ultimately, the horror is too horrible for it to be balanced by the humour. And that's a bit of a shame. I really liked Krampus for a number of reasons. I liked some of the actors in it. I liked the fact that they took a movie as well-known and well-loved as Christmas Vacation and twisted it into a proper comic horror kind of movie. I liked the little bits of referencing that go on, and of course referencing other films and other works is definitely a part of what horror comedy is about, particularly when they show a little clip of Alastair Sim playing Scrooge in the 1948, is it, version of A Christmas Carol. I like that referencing and that kind of layering of popular culture that goes on in these kind of movies. It's something Joe Dante did in a lot of his films and a few other people like that. And it's nice to see that tradition continuing and maybe giving... One of the nice things about that kind of layering where they reference other films is it's a way for people to go, hey, there's another film that has that bit in it. I'm going to find out what that film is and I'm going to watch it. So if a couple of people watch Krampus and then go back and watch the Alastair Sim version of A Christmas Carol, then good work has been done. And I think that's partly why people like Joe Dante and the kind of characters of his ilk, and I suppose even to a certain extent people like Steven Spielberg, put those little homages into their work. They're a teaser to get people to look at quality stuff in the past. And that referencing kind of acts as an education to the audience in some ways, should they wish to be educated. Personally, I love that kind of stuff. I love it when an unknown film noir turns up on a TV set in another movie and I go, okay, I'm going to find out what that is and watch that because it sounds like it might be interesting. That's the kind of stuff that movie buffs like myself live for in some ways. Well, that, coffee, sex and beef jerky. I picked up Krampus cheaply on Blu-ray. Occasionally, JB Hi-Fi do a $3 for $20 kind of deal on Blu-rays. And it's always a time to take a little chance and take a punt on a movie that you don't know whether you want to have it on Blu-ray or not. But it's kind of cheap. And when you get buy two, get one free, the free one you can kind of look at as something where you're going to take a punt and take a chance and look at something you might not look at otherwise. And Krampus was that in... what other movies did I get? I got a couple of other movies as well. I think one of them was, I got the two-disc Blu-ray version of Apocalypse Now and something else I wanted. And then I go, okay, well, fair enough, I'll grab Krampus as well. And I don't think it's a bad movie. I think it's a bit of fun. It's a good movie to show at Christmas time. And here we are 5 months away from Christmas, but what the fuck? It's cold weather here, so maybe that's the association. And in cynical times such as ours, it's hard to do Christmas movies. You either go too maudlin and sentimental and Spielbergian with them, or you kind of do the hipster kind of cynical and sardonic and ironic thing a little too much. The polarizing times we live in probably have a bit of an effect on those kind of movies. But Krampus, I think, steers the middle ground, even though the horror gets a little too dark for the comedy. It's worth checking out. Maybe, you know, back to back with National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I think the two of them kind of look good side by side. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to talk about a much more serious and arty film. Harry Kumail's 1971 Daughters of Darkness, starring Delphine Seyrig, John Carlson, Danielle Ouimet, and Andrea Rau.
Silly tales about ghouls chased away by garlic and vampires shrinking from crosses.
He kidnapped young girls and kept them chained to give blood. Blood for her to bathe in and drink.
And she bit them everywhere.
No.
And then she pushed white hot pokers into their faces. And when they parted their lips to scream, she shoved the flaming rod up into their mouth.
Stop it.
Blood. Beautiful red.
Stop it.
You're safe with me.
I killed no one.
Again.
It's difficult to forget.
Ah, you will. After a while, it'll only be the remembrance of a bad dream, and then the remains of a remembrance, more and more faint in your mind. I have seen many a night fall away into an even more endless night.
Nights like last night.
Who do you think I am? A kind of ghoul? A vampire? Oh, no, my dear.
Something. Wait until you meet Mother. She's something else.
Before Harry Kumail made the lesbian vampire movie Daughters of Darkness, known in French as The Red Lips, which is a really nice name, but may well have been misinterpreted in a world where Deep Throat had just come out. But anyway, before Harry Kumail, who was a Belgian writer-director, made Daughters of Darkness, he did a movie called Malbutui, which starred Orson Welles. And Harry Kumail was a great big Orson Welles fan. Massive Orson Welles fan, which is why in Daughters of Darkness somebody plays a cymbalom, which is a hammered dulcimer instrument. It's a kind of slight homage to a movie that Orson Welles didn't direct but that he starred in, The Third Man, which had a zither. It's got a kind of otherworldly sound about it, a cymbalom. People call it a hammered dulcimer in concerts. And it's kind of nice to see it in here. Now, the movie structure is fairly simple, and there's a lot of perversity in it, which is always a good thing as far as I'm concerned. It stars Delphine Seyrig, who had been last year at Marion Bad and was kind of an art house darling of the time in European cinema. She was, at the time, the paramour of Alain René, who encouraged her to do this stylish little lesbian vampire movie. She plays Countess Elizabeth Báthory, and because of Harry Kumail being such an old movie fan, they kind of played it a little bit like Marlene Dietrich. Ms. Dietrich was a little too old to play the role and wasn't available, but Delphine Seyrig played it a little bit like that. She also sounds a little bit like Joan Littlewood, the English actor, from what I can understand. Her partner, Ilona, played by Andrea Rau, and her turn up at a winter hotel in Ostend in Belgium, where they meet a honeymooning couple, played by John Cullen and Danielle Ouimet, Stéphane and Valerie, who are heading off for the boat to England. But for some reason, Stefan is a bit reluctant to take Valerie to see his mother. His mother disapproves of the marriage. We don't learn why until later. I'm not going to particularly spoil that. But there's a kind of undercurrent to it. They're very passionate when they start out. The first time we see them, in fact, they're making love. And it's wintertime in Ostend. The kind of waves are pounding. The skies are dark and grey. They're about the only people in this very posh hotel on the waterfront. And then the Countess and Ilona turn up. All stylish. The hotel clerk, played by Paul Esser, is a bit surprised to see the Countess because the last time he saw her was 40 years ago and she hasn't changed a bit, which is always a little bit of a worry. I'll read you the storyline that we have from IMDb. A chic, good-looking and suitably 70s couple arrive in an extravagant and deserted seaside hotel after eloping. Stefan is wealthy and happily English with a hidden streak of sadism, while Valerie is intelligent but inferior, in brackets, Swedish blood. I don't know if Swedish blood is inferior, but IMDb seems to think so. To keep her with him at the Erie Hotel, he lies constantly about his relationship with his mother and his plans to tell her of their marriage. Meanwhile, he has mysterious phone conversations. Well, I might go into that because it's a spoiler. Two fresh guests arrive, a Hungarian Countess, Elizabeth Bathory, and her voluptuous protege, Ilona. Virgin corpses begin showing up about the city, drained of their blood. A wary detective lurks around the hotel, taunting his only suspect, the Countess. So that's basically it. The movie isn't particularly about the plot. It's done slow and languidly, and there's a lot of atmosphere. The hotel itself is beautiful. In fact, it was filmed at two hotels. One, I think, in Bruges, and one in Ostend. And they kind of took the doors from one hotel and took them to the other hotel so they could match up the shots taking place between the characters. Now, this movie's interesting because, there's nudity and there's that kind of Kensington Gore kind of 1970s blood. And, of course, the Countess wants blood. But the interesting thing in looking at it from a 21st century movie watcher's viewpoint is the movie is about a vampire grooming somebody, or grooming two people, in fact. One to be her Renfield, Stefan, played by John Carlin, who later went on to have a career playing one of the husbands of the two characters in the TV series, Cagney and Lacey. He played Harvey Lacey, the husband in that. A fair while after, he was in Daughters of Darkness. Stefan is a complicated character, which is kind of interesting. He's in love with Valerie, and he's sexually sadistic and domineering, and at the same time, which is maybe a parallel to that, he's an insecure person as well. We find out why when we learn a little bit more about his mother, which makes it a very complex and twisted little tale. Valerie is kind of an innocent. She's quite beautiful. In fact, Danielle Wiemert, who plays Valerie, gets her kid off a fair bit, as indeed does John Carlin, and Andrea Rao playing Ilona, which the first time I saw this movie was quite fun and alluring. I even remember where I saw it. I saw it in the cinemas. Yes, I'm that old. In the 1970s at the State Theatre in Sydney. I was on a double bill, and I forget which movie it was with. It might have been, no, it wouldn't have been. I was going to say The Wicker Man, but I know I saw The Wicker Man there, but I don't know whether I saw them on the same double bill. But Daughters of Darkness has that kind of slow, languid pace and that seductiveness of Delphine Seyrig playing the Countess, playing the two younger people, much younger, in fact, if she's the original Countess, because she's at least 400 years old. But she's playing them and manipulating them and encouraging their darker passions in various ways, particularly Stefan's insecurities and his sexual sadism. She's mesmerizing these two young people. Meanwhile, Ilona, her companion, wants to feed and he's getting hungrier and obviously is another vampire. She's losing control of her thirst, which is not the Countess's way of doing things. And one of the strange things about vampirism in this movie is that it's not a violent thing. It's not an attack or a rape overtly. It's a seduction. The way that the Countess and Ilona do it is by seducing and kind of urging and grooming the people that ultimately they will feed on, rather than jumping off a balcony at them. It's very much a different way of going about it. The Countess isn't portrayed as being physically strong. She has a few vampire traits. She can't go out in daylight, and as we learn from one of the scenes with Alona, moving water is anathema to them. So when Stefan tries to get Alona into the shower, things go drastically wrong. But this vampirism is more about kind of hypnotism and mesmerism and animal magnetism and seduction. It's very much a gentler and, because of that, stranger kind of predation, which makes it really interesting and, at the time in the 1970s, very perverse. Because you've got to remember, at the time, lesbianism was a taboo. It wasn't something that every second celebrity celebrates. And fair enough, too, that they do. But it was very much a taboo. It was seen as sick and twisted. And even though, to the male gaze, watching two women making love was a crazy attractive thing, and remains so to this day, it was very much seen as a challenge to male sexuality rather than a sexuality of its own. Take a look at, say, a movie like Goldfinger, where pussy galore is gay until James Bond straightens her out. That's the kind of attitude the society had, that, like homosexuality, in a weird movie like Tea and Sympathy, which is a mainstream film of the late 1950s, where Deborah Carr seduces a young man out of being gay. Any non-straight sexuality was seen as a threat and a challenge to masculinity, in a way. Lesbianism, because the two women weren't interested in guys as they naturally should be, according to the ideas of the time. And homosexuality was something that men feared because they were scared that there was a bit of that in them and that their lives would go to hell and they'd be in jail and they'd get things jammed up their asses if they were like that. Every society has its fears, and the fears of the time from, say, Oscar Wilde until Stonewall was a fear of alternative sexualities. We really, as a society, were shit scared of them because they were a threat to the status quo and a threat to our image of ourselves. And so in this movie, you've got a stylish and sophisticated and beautiful countess who, even though she's gentle and friendly and talks nicely to people and and talks in a supportive, at the surface of things, way to everybody, she's very much a threat to the marriage of Valerie and Stefan from the viewpoint of the predominant society of the time. Now, Harry Cooper obviously didn't see it like this. He oddly and interestingly makes her a fairly sympathetic character in some ways. His vampires are fragile things in a number of ways. They can't go out in the light. They're emotionally sensitive, even while they're being incredibly emotionally manipulative. It's not really being passive-aggressive as much as being aggressive by another means, which is kind of really interesting. The colour palette of the movie is interesting as well. You've got the grey landscapes, the bright red of lipstick and dresses that the Countess wears, and the kind of muted pastel colours of the hotel, which kind of lulls us into a false sense of security when things get a bit red. When the Countess spends the night with Valerie, and where Stefan spends the night with Alona, and the aftermath of that, and what they need to do about that, and the emotional repercussions of it, and ultimately the splitting up of the couple. I'm not going to do too many spoilers, but the parting of the ways for the couple is all done in an emotionally gut-wrenching kind of way for the characters, and that's kind of cool. We get lulled in this European sophistication, this old hotel, this aristocratic countess, these beautiful young people, and then things start getting ugly. The movie's kind of like high glamour gothic perversity in a sense. It's erotic and it's weird, and it's unlike any other film. There have been other movies since that have emulated in some ways, one of which being The Hunger. It has that same kind of gentle, seductive lesbianism about it, which was in stark contrast to the way lesbians were portrayed in a lot of American movies, particularly one of the Tony Rome films with Frank Sinatra has a very butch lesbian with a beautiful stripper girlfriend, and it's portrayed as something sick and twisted rather than, you know, two people in love the way it should be. So this movie is contrary to that, which is one of the reasons why several film analysts who are lesbians find it a kind of keystone movie in that genre, because it is that point in society where we're starting to not demonize and be horrified by alternate sexualities. There is a gay subplot to the movie as well, which makes things even more interesting and gives us an extra level to play with and to think about in this film, which adds to the complexity of some of the characters. But at the guts of the film, you've got the story of an ancient predator finding a way that's under the radar and doesn't bring her very much to the attention of the authorities. And so she's found a way to be a vampire that's not in the Hammer style of ripping the throats out and leaving bucks and women lying in forests. There's none of that. Yes, there are corpses lying around with no blood in them, but the person doing that drives around in a very flash sports car, and because of her wealth and position in society, she's not necessarily seen as a suspect. Though there is the one cop who has his suspicions. The movie builds to a couple of really violent emotional climaxes and some physical violence and a car crash and an aftermath, which gives us a real understanding of the Countess and who and what she is. The car crash in particular is very well shot. It really is a bit surprising, and it kind of flirts with being graphic violence in some ways. The making of the movie is a little bit problematic too. At one stage, Harry Kummel punched out John Carlin. They really didn't get on during the making of the film, which probably added to the tension of the character in some ways, which probably worked in the favour of the movie. But if you compare this with a movie of roughly the same vintage, Hammer's The Vampire Lovers, the lesbian theme of the vampires in the movie are played two different ways. Harry Kummel's approach, and he was a writer and director, along with J.J. Amiel and Pierre Drouot. With Vampire Lovers, it's very much a traditional Hammer horror kind of film, with added tits and ass. But this film really plays it differently and plays it more obliquely and shows us a different kind of ancient monster in ways that ended up being very memorable. I mean, I had a copy of this movie on VHS tape. I think at one stage I had a DVD, but I now have it on Blu-ray, because it is very much an important landmark in vampire cinema and also in the portrayal of lesbianism in the movies. And it does owe a little bit too in style, the style of the violence, to Italian giallo cinema. There's a little bit of an influence there as well as art house cinema and various other little bits and pieces. Marlene Dietrich, for instance, and Andrea Rau's character was deliberately made up and has hairstyle reminiscent of Louise Brooks, the classic silent movie star. So there's lots of little bits and pieces. Kummel and the team grabbed little bits from here, little bits from there, and created something wholly their own. And it is a very worthwhile horror film. It's not fast-paced, but it gets you slowly, like the seduction of the certain characters by the Countess. It seduces you into the story and takes you along on a very slow and languid trip. So that's about it for Daughters of Darkness. I really enjoyed rewatching it. I hadn't seen it in a few years. And rewatching it, I had a new appreciation of it. I think the time before I watched it, I thought it was too slow, but I think the pacing actually works in favour of the story in this case. Maybe I've changed my view on it. As you can probably hear, my voice is giving out, and I apologise for that. So I'm going to end the podcast here. Thank you for listening, and thanks also to the Patreon subscribers who help finance the podcast with micropayments, particularly Kerry, our new studio accountant, and all of the other people I'm now going to mention in the credits to the podcast, done in the style of movie credits. So I'll be back next week with a Paleo Cinema podcast, and in 2 weeks with another Martian Driving podcast. Look after yourself, stay well, stay happy. Shout out to David Cummer in Minneapolis, who just had a heart operation. Stay cool, David, and everybody, keep watching good movies, keep watching bad movies, and take care until the next time I talk at you. And again, here are the credits to the podcast done in the style of movie credits to acknowledge the Patreon supporters. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Carrie, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.